We're really happy tonight to have Diane Wilson joining us. Diane is Executive Director of the Dream of Wild Health. And the Dream of Wild Health is a St. Paul nonprofit working to collect and save seeds once cultivated by Indian communities and in the process to improve health and teach young people about food and well-being. And Diane, I want to thank you and welcome you to the Roadhouse.
Well, hello. I appreciate the invitation to talk to you tonight.
Thank you. First of all, I just want to ask you about the name of your organization, the Dream of Wild Health, and how it relates to what you do there.
Well, the original vision for the organization actually came out of a dream that our founder had about starting a garden for these old seeds that would help Native families reconnect to traditional foods and medicines. And so that name was actually given to the organization by an elder.
And as I understand it, she had been collecting seeds?
Yeah, she had some seeds that were from her family, and then she'd also gotten seeds from other tribes. So she had begun a collection, and she was growing them out in a small garden in Farmington, Minnesota, which is about maybe 30 miles south of the Twin Cities.
Now, a lot of these seeds that are being collected, I was reading, you know, some of them have been, somebody had stored in a sock for who knows how long. How do they retain viability? We're kind of used to, you know, we buy seeds and a couple of years later, you know, you don't plant them because they don't grow, but is that really true?
Every year that you don't grow the seeds out, the viability reduces by a certain percentage. So they'll still grow, but you won't get quite the same productivity. So you think what a miraculous vessel these seeds are, that even after some of them have been known to grow out, even after a couple hundred years have gone by, or seeds have been discovered in archaeological digs and, you know, and it's possible that you can still grow them out. Difficult, very fragile, but still possible.
And I believe that Native populations had been growing a remarkable variety of foods in the past, and I don't imagine that there's any way to collect even a large proportion of those varieties anymore.
Well, and I know that a number of families continue to pass those seeds down from one generation to the next. So it kind of depends on how well each family maintained that seed inventory. But we were fortunate that a Potawatomi elder out in Wisconsin Dells, her name was Cora Baker. People were giving her seeds whenever they went by her farm and they saw her old corn that was hanging up, drying out by her barn. And so she managed to collect this large variety of seeds over her lifetime. And then when she was in her 90s and she was getting ready to pass, she heard about Dream of Wild Health, and so she gave her entire collection to the farm. So that's one of the ways you can still find seeds is through old collections and farms and families and in tribes. So it's something that we pay a lot of attention to, who still has collections. Sometimes people have a particular interest in collecting seeds. So the Science Museum, for example, has a fairly extensive collection of indigenous seeds that have come to them from various places.
How do you protect those seeds when you start growing them from genetically modified plants that are out there? I know it's a real problem if you have, say, a native type of corn growing next to some GMO corn.
Yeah, it's a huge issue. Our farm, in fact, is surrounded by cornfields, so what we have to do for any plant that can cross-pollinate, which is both corn and squash, it's best if you can segregate it to as much as possible where it's growing. And then we actually hand-pollinate and bag the seeds that we want to to save specifically for future generations as a way of maintaining that genetic integrity. So it is a very labor-intensive process, which makes it difficult to grow seeds out to any large scale. But it also makes it more of a community event if you can get people who are interested in learning how to hand-pollinate. And to me, that's one of the most magical moments of working with plants, is that time when the pollen is ready and just before those ears are beginning to silk, and to actually be involved in working with that pollen and helping those ears of corn become full ears, the same corn that our ancestors ate for generations. That to me is a really beautiful process, but it is a bit complicated and time consuming.
Getting back to the name Dream of Wild Health, is there a correlation between the foods that are consumed now and health of Native people?
Oh, absolutely. When you look at the fact that diabetes, for example, is epidemic in Native communities, it has to do with the fact that you take people who 150 years ago were living on in a very seasonal way. So, for example, the Dakota people in Minnesota were hunters, gatherers, and also grew some cultivated foods. But the big thing was to eat locally grown foods and eat them when they are seasonally ready. And so it was a very well-balanced, diverse diet full of nutrient-dense foods. And then when tribes were moved onto reservations and that traditional way of living was replaced with a diet of commodity foods, which are very high in starch and fat, then that's within a generation or two of that transition, then you start to see those diabetes rates just escalate.
So that's probably a genetic problem in people's ability to process some of these foods, just as glutens are for so many people.
Yes, and, you know, there's a high level of gluten and lactose intolerance in Native communities, too. These were not foods that were part of our traditional diets. And, you know, you hear about the thrifty gene, too, that when you're living closer to the seasonal foods, then you're more likely to go through periods when, you know, you may not have enough food or certainly you're not bulking up the way you do with carbohydrates and starches. And so there's been some research done to talk about the possibility of a thrifty gene in Native people, meaning it helped them survive through times of less food availability. And so now when we've got all this overabundance of supersized foods, then, of course, that thrifty gene is not helping.
In the overall population, it's difficult to get past the expense of eating healthy. A lot of people just can't afford to go in and buy a lot of the foods that they really should be eating because processed foods are so much cheaper. Do you find that's a problem as you try to get more Native people interested in growing and eating foods such as we're talking about here?
Well, I do think it's a perception that processed foods are cheaper, but I don't think it's really based in reality. And when you think of how just a generation ago everybody had a garden that they were growing, and to me, if we were to get back to more of a practice of growing our own food and being connected to the getting back to cooking and preserving our own foods, I think that we'll find that it is much more affordable than what processed foods are. And especially when you look at the long-term cost in terms of our health that comes from eating highly processed foods, then, you know, there's no comparison in my mind. I think there are food habits that people get into, and I, you know, and it seems to me that those combined flavors of salty foods, very sweet and high fat, that once your body adapts to that, it's very difficult to change those habits, those tastes. So one of the things we work on a lot at the farm is learning how to cook in a way that is very affordable, that is, but also really, really delicious. And then we encourage the kids who are in our program to taste the food so that you're coming back to a sense of really enjoying your food, really enjoying the flavors that are in, you know, that are part of home-cooked meals. And so, you know, I think that that's really the secret to finding healthy foods to be affordable.
We're speaking with Diane Wilson. Diane is Executive Director of Dream of Wild Health. Diane, we talked initially about your group saving native seeds and finding native seeds that you can save, but as you were just mentioning, another big part of what you do is teaching young people how to farm and how to cook the food that they're raising.
Yeah, yeah. It's a really wonderful part of our program. And part of it was the belief of Cora Baker, that's the Potawatomi elder who had saved all these seeds. It was really her belief that the best way to try to prevent diabetes is to help especially our native youth reconnect to these traditional foods. And so bringing back these old seeds, growing out the corn, the squash, and the beans that we've actually had tested, and they've proven to be much higher in antioxidants, for example, than our current market varieties. And so when we bring kids to the farm, we get them involved in growing out these old foods and showing them why they're so important, and then teaching them how to cook with them so that even when you're a teenager, you can learn how to make healthy snacks, you can learn all the basics of nutrition, you can learn how to live in a way that prevents diabetes from becoming an issue.
When you spend, when any culture spends 150, 200 years away from what they traditionally do to some degree, there's bound to be some loss of that traditional knowledge. Is part of what you do collecting traditional lore?
Yeah, that's an important part, is trying to restore that cultural understanding to families of how we as Native people lived in this state, in this country. The big thing is rebuilding this relationship with the land, in which you acknowledge the earth as the mother that provides all the gifts that we receive, so that you see food as a gift. And when you're in relationship with the land, then really you're accepting gifts, but you're also giving back. So it's really important to us to nurture the land that we're using. It was a conventional farm, and so one of the issues we have is restoring the fertility to it. But that idea of rebuilding a relationship with your food, for example, so that it's those plants and that land are no longer just a commodity, something to be bought and sold, but actually a living being that you have a relationship with, then that changes. That begins to change your whole understanding of your relationship with your food.
I don't know if Dream of Wild Health has moved into this part of traditional life, but of course a lot of the foods and medicinal plants were non-domesticated. They were just found in the wild in the past. Is that also something that your organization is looking at as far as lore is concerned?
Well, we actually have a staff person during the summer whose specialty is wild gathering. So we see the work that we're doing, which is growing cultivated foods, as being one part of what would have been a year-long annual diet, so that in the summertime you're cultivating your foods, but you're also gathering foods as they become ready. And so our staff person has been just incredibly helpful in terms of taking our kids out and our families out, and we go gathering so that we'll gather. We gathered hazelnuts, for example, when they became ripe. We gathered choke cherries, which was a really important traditional food. You can gather lots of plants for teas, for example. And she gathers birch bark. She teaches the kids how to make baskets. So that's a really important part of what we're also trying to teach these kids. But we don't have, you know, for example, we want them to learn about wild ricin and maple syrup gathering. And so we don't have those resources at the farm, but then we collaborate with other groups so that we can help those kids learn the seasonality of their foods.
And are all Native kids have the availability to come to Dream of Wild Health? Are there opportunities for many of them, or are you a little limited just because of space?
Well, we have a van that holds 14.
Okay.
So that's pretty much the limit.
You.
We drive down, well, we pick them up in the cities, and then we drive them up to the farm every day. It's about 30 miles north of St. Paul. And then they spend all day with us for 4 weeks. And then in that 4 weeks, they've pretty much learned the basics of gardening and cooking. They learn a lot about their culture. They do a lot of, handcrafts like birch bark basket making. They learn archery. We also teach them job skills. So then when we take our vegetables, for example, because we do have a full market vegetable garden that has everything in it you'd ever find at a farmer's market, and we bring those down to two markets in the cities that are very convenient for Native families, and the kids work. So they're also learning job skills, and we pay them a stipend for the work that they do at the farm.
I know that up in Grand Portage, they're working at establishing another community garden up there. They have one that they've established beforehand. Is Dream of Wild Health looking to work with other groups to do similar things?
Oh, yeah, we do a lot of collaborating. We couldn't do the work that we do without some really great partners, because we have a farm and we have a lot of resources and knowledge around gardening. But, for example, we work with a lot of urban organizations who work directly with families, and that's how we get a lot of our kids referred. But we're also really interested in working with other organizations around the state, thinking that the more we get people involved in gardening on any level, whether it be your own garden, a community garden, or just a tomato in a container, that it's beneficial for all of us. That we really take control back of our food system and really pay attention to where our food is coming from. So it would be wonderful to collaborate with them.
Diane, is there a website that folks can go to learn more about your organization?
Yeah, we have a website with a lot of great information on it, and that is www.dreamofwildhealth.com. .org, and that's all one word.
That's great. We've been speaking with Diane Wilson, and Diane is the executive director of Dream of Wild Health. And Diane, I want to wish you all the best of luck with your organization as you move along, and hope that sometime we can talk to you again.
Well, thank you very much for calling.